You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. Today, our special guest is Dr. Blaine Johnson, Assistant Professor of Food Animal Medicine and Surgery with the Texas Tech School of Veterinary Medicine. He'll join us in just a moment. First off, economic researcher Jim Davis on the Rural America at a Glance.
So this year's Rural America at a Glance report includes five main findings. We find that the rural population has continued to grow. We also find that rural poverty has been modestly declining. A third, we find that housing insecurity continues to be a persistent issue, particularly for low-income households. Fourth, we find that rural employment has essentially recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. And then finally, we look at rural clean energy jobs and find that 1% of jobs in rural America are in industries such as solar and biofuels.
This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James, joined today by Dr. Blaine Johnson, Assistant Professor of Food Animal Medicine and Surgery with the Texas Tech University School of Veterinary Medicine. Wow, I didn't realize I'd run out of breath giving your title there, but that's a lot for one business card, isn't it?
Yeah, and I just like to say I'm one of the cow guys here that does cattle medicine, so it's kind of easier to, you know, it's easier to interpret too for a lot of people.
Well, Let's interpret how you got to where you are today. We're going to talk about the Texas Tech School of Veterinary Medicine in just a moment, a brand new school. But let's get a little background on you first and your path to where you are today. Did it start on a farm or a ranch?
Yeah, I actually grew up on a small farm. If I would stay there, I think I would have been a fifth generation farmer on our farm, but I kind of let my brother take that over in Southwest Iowa, a little town called Red Oak. That's where it all started. And from there, my education kind of has just taken me all sorts of places. Iowa State grad for undergrad in 2000, well, it's been a while, 10. And then I went down to Oklahoma State, did a nutrition master's down there. And then I went back to Iowa State, finished veterinary school, and after veterinary school, I went out and practiced. I actually ended up practicing in my hometown for a little over a year, and then had an opportunity to join a group up in Canada that did exclusively feedlot consulting as well as some cow-calf medicine. So I figured I was young enough, I could take that opportunity and run with it because you never know what might happen. And I ended up in Canada for a year and a half doing feedlot and cow-calf medicine. And then after that, my wife and I decided it was time to get closer to home because we just had a little young boy born, and ended up in Northwest Iowa doing mixed animal practice. And I decided I needed some more education and ended up at Kansas State University doing a PhD in epidemiology focusing in heart disease in the feedlot cattle. And after I completed that, which I'm about getting to my year anniversary of completion of that from Kansas State, I joined the School of Vet Medicine here at Texas Tech in Amarillo and started last January. So that's kind of the long path to how I got here.
Well, let's talk now about the School of Veterinary Medicine. Brand new. What's the elevator speech for the new school?
Yeah, so we are probably one of the newest veterinary schools that has opened their doors here in the last few years. It's a different take on veterinary medicine per se. So up until the last, let's recent 10 years or so, there's been a couple of new schools, but a lot of them have been the traditional routes, veterinary education, which I was a graduate of at Iowa State. But now our school here at Texas Tech, we focus on, you know, really implementing a lot of clinical skills into their education. So while they're learning all the normal, the abnormals, they're actually getting integrated with animals their first year. They're doing physical exams. So we're trying to put a hands-on learning approach with students and working around that with our education model. And, I mean, we're working on our third class of students currently. So we have veterinary students in their first, second, and third years here at Texas Tech University. And we're rolling into our third years currently. Are going into their spring semester, be the last traditional education, and then they'll roll into their clinic year. And all their clinics is in a distributed model here with Texas Tech. So that means they're going to be at various clinics throughout the state of Texas and a few that will be in New Mexico as well, and maybe a couple in Oklahoma. So those students will be rotating around for a year to get in their clinical experience before they sit for their board exams. A year from now, pretty much, is when they'll be taking their veterinary board exams so they can practice veterinary medicine. So it's a new school, and I tell you, it's running a pretty fast pace currently.
Well, we're moving into cooler weather, and when I say cooler weather, you're somebody who knows what cooler weather really is, especially if we're talking about Iowa and north. But wintertime and cattle, are there some things that the producers can do to prepare cattle for the winter?
Yeah, so now we're moving into winter. It's still relatively warm currently, but as you can tell, most of the poor and the lack of rainfall we've been having, all of our forage sources have really been depleting, and the maturity of our forage has gone up quite a bit as well. So we're not getting as much out of the forage we have from a nutritional standpoint as we were in previous times earlier this summer. So we need to start thinking about what we have in store so we can carry our cattle over the wintertime and make sure we're not going to lose too much body condition or need to have to bring in more nutrients to supplement any of those cows that require more nutrition because they've, I don't know, either ran down a little too much this summer or weren't getting an adequate amount of forage in the pastures that they were in. So main things we need to start looking at and getting our cows ready, the easiest thing would be to, one, get your cow's pregnancy evaluated by a veterinarian and determine how many open cows you have. And those would be the first cows I would remove from the herd and try to get them away. That way you have more available groceries for your cows that are actually going to be in production, those being the animals that are pregnant. So that would be the first thing that I would recommend all producers doing is making sure we knew who is pregnant and who's not pregnant and whether they need to stay in the herd or not. In my opinion right now with the current cattle market and the way hay prices are, I would move those cattle on down the line that are open. And then second is trying to determine how much forage we have available from our hay stock. So we need to make sure we have an adequate number because hay is probably going to get pricey again as we move into the later winter months here, and especially if it gets cold. Currently, the weather's been pretty favorable from a temperature standpoint. We haven't gotten too cold yet, but if it gets too cold, that's going to push our energy requirements up a little higher. And our cattle that are entering their third trimester, that's when our highest energy demands are going to be for that animal. So we need to make sure that we know which animals are going to be rolling into that third trimester and determine if we need a supplement on top of our hay or how much we need to supplement on top of our hay. And we typically evaluate that by doing a body condition score on those cows. So any animals that are falling below like a body condition 5 out of 9, those animals probably need a little bit more supplement going into their gestation here and try to get them up to that 5 to 6 standpoint before we get into calving. And because typically the first couple of months of calving, those animals are going to lose body condition. So we need to make sure we're at an adequate level or maybe a little above. That way we're not going to lose any more in the subsequent breeding season. And then I guess the last way, a major point that kind of gets overlooked is water availability. We need to make sure that there's fresh water available for cattle at all time, even in the winter months. You wouldn't think is as big of a deal, but even though it's cold, they still require water for a lot of bodily functions. So making sure they have adequate water supply is one thing we don't want to overlook, even when it's cold out.
Lane, we've been talking about, preparing those cattle for the winter, entering that third trimester, but also probably a pretty good time to stop and think about the bull side of this, especially as some start looking to rebuild their herds where they can. Is there some guidance we need to keep in mind when we're going out shopping for bulls?
Yeah, and I, as you can tell, Robbie, right about now, you're seeing a lot of bull catalogs hit your mailbox. And bull sales are going to be starting to pick up December through March. It's probably the hottest time frame. I see a lot of bull sales going on. And the biggest thing we need to determine is what your current bull battery power is. I mean, so when I say that is, do we have an adequate amount of bulls that we need for our cows? Are any of our bulls getting old and need to be removed from the herd? That way we keep our genetic profile moving forward and we're not having too much issues with inbreeding or line breeding in our cattle populations. And then once we figure out if we need to buy new bulls, replace bulls in our herd, the next thing is what are our goals for our herd? Are we going to target a production where we're keeping replacements out of this or potential bulls that we're going to look for? Or are we looking for more of a terminal sire, which we sell all of our calves off, either as weaning or stockers coming in the subsequent breeding season? So those are, that would be the first hurdle I'd want to make sure that we cover if we're looking and thinking about a new bull to add to our herd, is what is our herd goal? And then from there, it can get pretty nitpicky on what we need to figure out on the look at our bulls. And that goes down into our EPDs, so our expected progeny differences. And this can be really kind of overbearing at times, because there's a lot of numbers that are going to be thrown in front of you from an EPD standpoint for individual bulls. And trying to determine which EPDs that you need to match for your herd kind of align with what target you're going for. So if we're looking for bulls that are going to produce replacement heifers for our herd, we need to probably target some more maternal traits, those being Cavanese maternal, scrotal size, and frame scores, and milking abilities out of the bull's genetics. And if we're looking for more of a terminal sire, then we need to think about our growth traits. And those would be our yearling weights, our weaning weights, our dollars of beef produced on some of our EPDs that get populated. There's a lot of different indexes and numbers out there. And thankfully, a lot of these catalogs will have a breakdown of what all these EPDs mean and what are the traits that go into it. So if you ever get into a point where you're not sure on something, you can either contact your veterinarian, your local extension officer, or you can contact the producer, as they have a pretty good understanding of what a lot of these EPDs are for, and they can hopefully target a bull that might meet your needs. And I would say it's a lot to think about, but it's good to start thinking about it earlier, because you never want to get to a point where you need a bull and you can't find one, because that's not a good situation to be in.
Blaine, it's great to visit with you. Will you come back and see us somewhere down the road?
You know, I'd love to. It's fun talking with you.
And if we want to learn more about the Texas Tech School of Veterinary Medicine, is there some place we can find that online?
You bet. So we have our website, and that's just Texas Tech University School of Veterinary Medicine. So that's dps.ttu.edu/vetschool/. And that'll bring you to our home website. And from there, there's all sorts of information that you can look into and learn more about the vet school.
Dr. Blaine Johnson is Assistant Professor of Food Animal Medicine and Surgery with the Texas Tech University School of Veterinary Medicine, and joins us on today's Agribusiness Report.
If you're going to succeed, you need cotton that's strong enough to perform around here where you grow. That's why Delta Pine cotton varieties are bred to meet the needs of your neck of the woods and are rigorously evaluated by local growers for maximum performance potential and consistency year after year. Strong cotton performance starts around here with locally tested Delta Pine cotton. Learn more at deltapine.com. Read and follow pesticide label directions, grain marketing, and other stewardship practices.
Life doesn't come with guarantees, but working with Rob Seco comes pretty close. Our strategic investments in the seed we offer are designed to directly improve your bottom line. From full trait platforms, breeding and development, to field-by-field planning and seed-driven crop inputs, with Rob Seco, you have precisely what you need to improve plant performance and increase yield. Every farm, every crop, and every acre. Learn more at robseco.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. Again, our special guest, Dr. Blaine Johnson with the Texas Tech Vet School.
Join us at the Amarillo Farm and Ranch Show, November 28th through 30th at the Amarillo Civic Center. Connect with hundreds of exhibitors showcasing the latest ag technology and attend agriculture-focused seminars, too. Earn your certification at the Beef Quality Assurance Training or attend livestock education sessions with the Texas Tech School of Veterinary Medicine. Hear from experts at the Cotton Conference, earn CEU credits, or attend the Texas Wheat Symposium. It's all happening at the Amarillo Farm and Ranch Show. Visit AmarilloFarmShow.com for more information.
Success is attained by those who approach problems with a plan and a purpose. As an advocate for High Plains cotton growers since 1956, Plains Cotton Growers has been tackling the tough issues facing cotton growers through beneficial legislative and regulatory changes. An important part of PCG's success is through close working relationships with congressional representatives and federal regulatory staff, allowing cotton growers more time to devote to farming operations. From the halls of Congress to the dusty turnroads of the High Plains, cotton producers depend on Plains Cotton Growers.
You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. You can find all of our interviews at allagnews.com.
Let's talk about cotton research. Cotton Incorporated funds more than 400 ag research projects every year. They study cotton, engineering, economic development, entomology, agronomy, pathology, variety selection, expanded cotton seed uses. And that's just the start. You grow the cotton research and promotion program helps grow the value. Learn more at cottonboard.org.
If you're going to succeed, you need cotton that's strong enough to perform around here where you grow. That's why Delta Pine cotton varieties are bred to meet the needs of your neck of the woods and are rigorously evaluated by local growers for maximum performance potential and consistency year after year. Strong cotton performance starts around here with locally tested Delta Pine cotton. Learn more at DeltaPine.com. Read and follow pesticide label directions, grain marketing, and other stewardship practices.
It's the Agribusiness Report.
Now on the home stretch of its month-long tour of its home state, the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree. It is this Friday when
it will get delivered to the Capitol building. At that point, we pass the tree off to the architect of the Capitol.
Amy Albright of the U.S. Forest Service in West Virginia says the 63-foot Norway spruce will be decorated up to its November 28th lighting ceremony. Some of the decorations made by West Virginia school children.
Up to 10,000 handmade ornaments that would help represent what makes West Virginia endlessly wild and wonderful. And they really, really pulled through.
19 Mountaineer State communities were stops along the route of the tree called Wathantekwi, Bright Star in the language of the Shawnee Tribal Nation. Forest Service personnel also took time during these stops and throughout the year conducting outreach and education about the Capitol Christmas tree and our nation's forest. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.